Greetings in Jesus' name. Special welcome to our visitors this morning. Would you turn to Matthew chapter 5? We're working our way down through Jesus' great manifesto of his kingdom. In the spring of 1894, the Baltimore Orioles came to Boston to play a routine baseball game. But what happened that day was far from routine. One of the Orioles players, John McGraw, got into a fight with the Boston first third baseman. And it wasn't long till all the players on both sides were involved in this fight. And then the people in the grandstands got involved, and somebody got so mad he set fire to the grandstands and burned the baseball diamond to the ground. And the fire spread and burned, partially at least, and some completely, 107 other buildings in Boston. All because somebody was mad at a third baseman. This story sort of confirms the statement by Seneca that anger is a brief insanity. That incident surely pictures that. It also illustrates what Cicero, a Roman philosopher, said. When anger enters the scene, nothing can be done rightly or sensibly. Now, the title of the morning message is Eliminating Our Enemies. And we first of all need to deal with this whole issue of anger. Anger is the natural response to some injustice or wrong. It's actually something God gave us, that reaction. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that later. And it gives us some motivation to eliminate the wrong. That's good. But the law, even the law of the Old Testament, warned to not let that impulse go to an extreme and eliminate the wrongdoer by killing him. Now, Jesus now tells us how to eliminate our enemies by a new and living way. And that's what this message is about this morning. He takes us to the heart of the law. And maybe I didn't make as clear as I should have the last time. The eternal law is God's moral law. Moses' law was added because of transgressions. It's because people could not respond to that moral law like Abraham did or like Joseph did. And so God had to treat them like children and be a schoolmaster to them and say, do this, do this, do this, do this, and spell out a whole bunch of details, which weren't complete. They didn't completely express that moral law. What was there was good. And it took people part way to some sense of humanity and some sense of equity. But when you spell things out like that, it's never complete. One time I asked when I was a teacher, what's the problem with legalism? And I wish I could remember the student who was perceptive enough to say, you can't ever write enough rules. And that was true with the Mosaic Law. The moral law, if properly understood, encompass all of life and put it all in its proper perspective. And so what Jesus did is he came and he harked back to that moral law, and he said that law will never pass away. And is to the extent that the Mosaic law embodied that concept of the moral law, those concepts also will not pass away. Now, there was a lot in the moral law that was ceremonial. There was a lot in the moral law that was civic. There was a lot in the moral law to keep a nation healthy in the desert who had no doctors. There was a lot of that in the law, and it's a little hard to separate sometimes some of that with the moral law. But anyway, I thought I should clarify that. It's the moral law that's never going to pass. That just isn't going to happen until the universe passes away, because it's wrapped up in the universe. Jesus said, till heaven and earth pass away, you can't get rid of this law because it's all part of the created order. So, Jesus now takes us to the heart of the law. And he basically shows us in about six different applications here from now on in this passage that what we're talking about is reverence. Reverence for the things that are eternal, people. He talks about our word. He talks about women. He talks, all right, reverence, just reverence, having a proper reverence for things. In this case, we're going to be talking about a reverence for every human being on this earth. All of our actions are going to be judged by our reverence for every bearer of God's image. And Jesus takes us back to the warning God gave Cain before he killed his brother. We have this right back at the beginning. He said to Cain, "Why are you angry?" And he's talking about anger, which we're going to talk about here. And it was amazing to me that there in the beginning of Genesis, we have this, the concept that Jesus is dealing with. He says, "Why are you angry? Cain, I'm warning you, sin crouches at your door, and its desire is for you, and you must master it." So God here is describing sin as an enemy crouching at the door. And the specific sin was anger, or the way Cain at least was participating in it. Cain ignored that warning, and he killed his brother. And so Jesus is taking us back to that very warning, that when we sense anger rising in us, he says sin lies at the door. We're not saying that all anger is wrong. Jesus one time said he looked about with anger. But it's a very, very volatile emotion. And it's lying at the door, and it wants to overpower us and lead us to something more terrible, such as killing. All right. So, we want to talk about how this crouching sin can be mastered. First thing we're going to talk about is silence anger. 5:21-22. And then we want to talk about seeking accommodation. And that will be 5:23-24. And then finally, we want to talk about solicit agreement. 5:25-26. So that will be our outline for the morning. Let's read the passage. Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause," and I'll just tell you right now, "without a cause" was not in some of the best manuscripts. And some people believe that King James had a personal enemy, that he thought he had a cause to be angry with him. And so it's thought that maybe, I'm not sure I could document that, that he insisted that this be put in, because it was in some of the manuscripts. You'll notice that most of your modern translations leave it out, because it does sort of give you an excuse to be angry. And so let's read it the way at least some of the major manuscripts read it. "Whosoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing." Now, they tell us, and I always say it that way because you know that I don't know Greek except what I read and what I'm told, and David Berceau tells us all that's very suspect. But that we are told that the Greek language has two words for anger. And I have reason to believe that's true. The one word for anger is a quick blaze like a flame in a pile of straw. It burns hotly, and then it's gone. And that's it. The other word is a brooding anger that is nursed inwardly and is not permitted to die. It's constantly fed and encouraged. A smoldering wrath that finally breeds destruction. That's why the scripture says, be angry and sin not. I think that verse is basically saying that little blaze of anger against injustice. Don't let that go very far. That might get you started in helping to get the injustice taken care of. It might be your signal that something needs to be done. But make sure the sun doesn't go down. Make sure it burns and goes out. I think that's what that passage means. It might get you started on a good path to do something. But if you let that, if you nurse that, and you don't let it die, and you let it smolder, then you're going to have major problems. Never let this first fire, this quick blaze, turn into this second one. I think that's basically what that scripture is saying. Don't allow yourself to accumulate grievances and fuel for that little blaze of anger that should have blazed up, got you started in doing something good, and then it went out. Don't feed it. Don't just keep putting fuel on it and accumulating grievances and remembering histories and hearing stuff from other people and, you know, whatever we do. You know how it goes. Murder begins when we let our anger cause us to begin to lose respect for the infinite worth of the person that we're angry at. That little blaze of anger should not be permitted to start to demean the person. Okay? Which is the problem. When people are mistreated, it's because the person who's mistreating them has demeaned them. He felt that person is somehow worthy of him dominating that person. That person is beneath him. U.S. slavery was based on that. They had to make themselves believe that these people were not really humans. And I remember the incident in Uncle Tom's Cabin. I don't remember very many specific instances there, but the one that really struck me was there was this woman, slave woman, or she had been captured, or she had been bought and was being transported down the river on a boat, and she had a baby. It was her baby. And the slave owner wanted to sell the baby because he didn't want the baby. He just wanted the woman. So he waited until she had gotten up to do something and left the baby on the bench. And then he took the baby and went with it. She came back and the baby wasn't there. And she jumped overboard. And somebody, in commenting on this, was asking why did they think that she would not grieve for this baby. And the comment was made, well, you know, these people are like animals. You know, a cow will bawl for a day or two, and then she soon forgets. You see what's happening here? This is horrible. And slavery was based, whatever that represents, slavery was based on that demeaning of people to the level of animals. It's just a horrible thing when you think about it. Now, Jesus shows us three steps to that kind of demeaning attitude. The first is anger, brooding resentment. It starts with hurt feelings, self-pity, a sense of not being treated right, sense maybe wanting more attention or being jealous that other people have more attention than you know, all of these personal things. It starts with something like that. And the early signs of it are sulking, pouting, and withdrawal. But like the song we just sang, when we sense that starting to happen to us, now I'm talking about ideals. I'm talking about things that happen to me. I'm talking about things I don't deal with the way I should deal with them. I'm just being very honest. I'm presenting what should happen here now. When you sense that self-pity, when you sense that hurt feeling, the song here says, catch the wandering of the will. And quench it right there. Now, if you say you can't, you're denying the grace of God. Because God does not ask us to do things He does not enable us to do. So if Jesus says it's wrong to be angry with your brother, and He's using this smoldering anger, it's wrong to go down that road and allow that to happen, then we have to believe that it's possible for us to quench the kindling fire and not let that anger be with us overnight. We have to believe that's possible. We have to believe that every person in this congregation who encounters this little blaze of anger would be able, by God's grace, to catch it if he had the sensitivity. This song talks about being sensitive. Give me, let's see, how does it say? It says, a sensibility of sin, a pain to feel it near. So when we feel that first little prick of anger, we should immediately deal with it. That's what Jesus is saying. Make no excuses. That without a cause is an excuse. That's an excuse. Let's get real practical. Let me give an example. Abraham had a Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, who got very angry at an officer that had accused him of favoritism. Stanton complained to Lincoln, who suggested that he write a letter. So Stanton did that. He wrote a very sharp letter, strongly worded and ugly. Then he had Lincoln read it, and Lincoln said, well, what are you going to do with it? Oh, he said, I'm going to send it, of course. Well, Lincoln said, the reason I wanted you to write it is so you could burn it. So just go right over to the stove and put that in the fire. You got all your feelings on that paper. You dealt with that little blaze of anger. Put it in the fire and sit down now and write the right kind of letter to this man. That's how we should treat this. If you have to write a letter, write it, but then make sure you burn it. All right? Now, if we don't do this, it says we will be in danger of the judgment court, which this here, now what he's picturing here is the local court in your little town. It doesn't go beyond that. In other words, your local people will bring you into judgment. They'll sense this attitude. And you're not going to get any favorable press out of it. But people are going to know he has an attitude. He's pouting. He's pitying himself. We just kid ourselves when we think we're not telling the whole world that we have this attitude. And so he says that if you don't deal with the attitude, you'll come under the scrutiny and judgment of the local council, the local town council. And I'm broadening it to the local community. I find this very inspiring, that it's actually possible to deal with anger at this level by the power of the Holy Spirit. I don't think we can do it on our own. We need to deliberately be positive. Let me give you a better example. Many years ago, a senior executive in the Standard Oil Company made a wrong decision that cost that money $2 million. And this was back almost a century ago when John D. Rockefeller was the head of that organization. On the day that the news leaked out about this loss, most of the executives didn't even want to meet Mr. Rockefeller because they knew he was going to be as angry as could be, and they were all going to have to hear his tirade of anger against this man. But there was one exception. He had a partner that had to meet with him that day. So he sort of braced himself and went into the office just ready to hear this. He found Mr. Rockefeller bending over his desk making notes. And he walked up behind him, and on the head of the paper, he saw that it said, just a minute here. I want to get the exact title. Well, anyway, I can't find it in my notes. He saw on the head of the paper, it said, this person's good points. And Mr. Rockefeller had listed all the good points that he could remember about this man. He remembered the time, three times in the history of this man's work for the company, that he had made decisions that had saved the company more money than they now had lost. And he listed all of them. And he told this man, he said, I was making these notes so that when this man comes into my office, I will be prepared to relate to him in a way that's right. That's the kind of practical action we have to take. If we don't, it goes to the next level. We call our brother Raka. Now, they say this is an untranslatable Greek term, and it has a sort of a flavor of onomatopoeia. That is, the word itself sounds like what it is. And if you, and I'm not going to try to say it, but they say that if a Hebrew pronounces this word, it sounds like clearing your throat to spit on somebody. That's what's communicated. Contempt. And at this level, then what begins to happen? Well, up until this point, it's an attitude. Now it begins to be expressed in words of contempt. This word raka, if it's to be understood, they say that it would mean an empty-headed blunderer, a brainless idiot, to use the modern term, a nerd, a doofus. That's how you begin to talk. You begin to this smoldering resentment. Remember, it's a smoldering resentment. If you'd have quenched that blaze, this wouldn't have happened. But you let it smolder, and now it is coming out. All right? The person begins to be devalued publicly by our comments. It's the exact opposite of Philippians 2, verse 3, that says, let each esteem other better than themselves. That's one of the most challenging verses in the whole Bible. How in the world do people like us, who think more than we should even at our best, about number one, maintain an attitude that everybody else, including our enemies, are better than we are? You see, we're to value people above us, not beneath us. And there again, if it says we're to esteem others better than ourselves, then we have to believe the grace of God makes that a possibility, that that's not an unreasonable ideal. I'm not there yet, I must admit. I think I've made some progress. But I'll give you an example. On the phone line the other day, a man said something he didn't realize. He just about knocked me off my chair. It was such a rebuke that I almost couldn't digest it. He was an evolutionist. And so I was describing what seems to me the foolishness of evolution. And I said to him, among other things, that when I was a student in biology, the first thing we studied was spontaneous generation. We laughed at the idea that the ancients had, that rats came out of trash piles, therefore the rats were generated by the trash pile. And then I said, at the end of biology, I reflected that we just had gotten a sophisticated version of the same thing, that matter turned into life all by itself. And then I chuckled. And he took that personally because he was an evolutionist. And he said, you've been saying my friend, my friend, my friend to your congregation. You quit saying that. You are not my friend. You do not have a good attitude toward me. My chuckle was demeaning him. I was laughing at him. And if we're not careful, that's the attitude that we tend to have. I mean, I must admit, I think evolution is foolish. I don't know if I think the people who believe it are foolish people, but maybe I have too much that, but I didn't even think about it. I was sort of chuckling at the stupidity of the idea, but I was demeaning him. We tend to put ourselves above and look down. There's all kinds of snobbery. There's snobbery of position, there's snobbery of finances and money, there's snobbery of education, there's all kinds of things that people do or get involved in that make them feel like they have an edge over everybody else. And I think if I were to ask you to raise your hand, every one of us would say that we so readily participate in this in our whole mentality toward other people. I'm speaking from experience. But Christ was the exact opposite. He chose to go from the top, and he was at the top. He is God. But he chose to go the whole way to the bottom so that God could truly exalt him. All right? Jesus was a great believer in mankind. He didn't have to be. He came to this earth. He saw the stupidity. He saw the ugliness. He saw the injustice. He saw the hopeless attitudes of the human family. And he could have just walked around with his head in the air. He was above all that. He really was. But he had tremendous faith that men could do what he's saying here. They could be. They were made in the image of God, and they could actually be this ideal. He believed that. He really believed that. He believed that about sinful people that he was with. He actually saw them as people capable of this level of human experience. The common people heard him gladly because he didn't consider them common people. There were three words on his lips constantly. The least, the last, and the lost. That's where his concern was, with these disenfranchised people all around him and the attitudes others had toward them. And so he tended to identify with the ones at the bottom because he thought there was as much hope for them and maybe more hope for them than there was for these others. He did not see these distinctions in his own mind, or he didn't feel them in his own heart. Contempt is an active hatred. It's an active anger, the smoldering anger. It's become active now. Booker T. Washington once said, "I will not allow any man to drag me so low as to make me hate him. I won't allow any person to do that." He had felt the sting and the pain and the cruelty of prejudice and hate. And he, through his life, tried to apply the golden rule. He tried to do unto others as a slave he would have wished they had done to him. Now, if we start to get into this active expression of anger, it says we'll be in danger of the council. This is more serious. This now is legal danger. The council was the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of the Jewish people. And he says this now has become serious enough to be a legal issue. If you're not careful, this contempt will get you in trouble with the Supreme Court of Israel. If we don't deal with it at that level, it passes to the next level, which is insult. Thou fool. Now the word fool here is the word does anybody see, can you think of a word related to that? Moron. It sort of has the idea of an immoral person in the Greek. So now we have branded this person as immoral, hopeless, and we basically take his name and his reputation from him. We ruin him in a way that can never be completely remedied. Okay? We've said he's worthless. I can do with him whatever I want to do with him. There are some people that think if you use the word fool, if you say to somebody you're foolish, that you're disobeying this test. I don't think it means that. I think it means to treat the person that way. I could give you some practical applications, but they'd hit too close home, so I just won't do that. The danger here is the fire of Gehenna. That's the valley where Ahaz burned children to his gods. That valley outside Jerusalem, and Josiah cursed that valley because of it. And because the valley was cursed, people brought their refuse there, and there was a constant burning there, and there was a smog of evil-smelling gases over that valley. It was just a despicable place. And it's a symbol of final destruction and disgrace. And he says, if you reach the level where you have truly devalued the brother and you've written him off as worthless and you've made sure the whole world knows that, you've reached a level where you're in danger of this fire. Final judgment. Now, we have three steps here. We have this long-lasting smoldering anger. That's bad. We have contemptuous speaking. That's worse. And we have actions to destroy a man's reputation. That's where you get to at the last. The next step is murder. Physical murder. Okay? If that is continued. So, he says we need to take action immediately. Okay? So there are two actions he mentions here. The first one is this one. Seek accommodation. All right? Clear up offenses just as soon as you are aware of them. Don't even put your religious duties ahead of these, because they are, in fact, a barrier between you and God at this point. In the Old Testament, they would bring their sacrifice and they would bring it to the priest. And when they would hand it to the priest, I don't know if he said it audibly or not, but the understanding was that confession of sin and restitution have to go hand in hand. And so the Jewish person who brought his sin offering against some person, a sin that he had done against somebody, was expected to answer the question as to whether or not he had made restitution, because the priest would not offer the offering unless it was guaranteed that the restitution had been done. And that's what Jesus is referring to here. He's saying, if you bring your gift to the altar, then remember that when you bring your gift to the altar and you have wronged somebody, you can't make your confessions until you have done your restitution. Okay? That's the point that he's making here. You take the initiative, even if you were not the cause. You know, the Anabaptists had this saying, no man can come to God unless he bring his brother with him. Now, that doesn't mean that every time you want to pray, you have to go get all the congregation together to pray. It simply means that while you're praying, the whole congregation is a part of that prayer. And if somebody in the congregation is not at peace with you, that is more important than the prayer. That's more important than your coming to God. Okay? Jesus said, if you don't forgive, you won't be forgiven. Just forget your prayer for forgiveness. You won't be forgiven if there's anybody that you haven't forgiven. The action of making restitution, I think, is a practical way to release the grace of God. I think you've all heard me tell the story of Corrie Ten Boom, and I love to tell it, where this guard that had been in the prison where she was, who was so dehumanizing and was the worst guard in the whole prison, one night after one of her meetings, comes walking up the aisle and with his hand outstretched saying, Corrie, will you forgive me? And she said, I felt no forgiveness in my heart. My heart was ice. I hated him. At that moment, I couldn't say that I had any love for him. But I knew that God could give me the strength physically to reach out my hand. And somewhere in the doing of that, God's grace was released. And by the time I clasped his hand, my heart was filled with love and forgiveness. And I could honestly say, brother, I forgive you. You see, God waits until we take the action. His grace is unlimited. You've seen me give that many times. But it just stays there until we act. That's why the restitution is necessary before the prayer is made. Because God wants to fill that restitution with grace, and he wants you to come there with all that in your heart. Okay? So, the second thing was seek accommodation. As soon as you sense there's something wrong, go and deal with it. Make the restitution, and then the grace will flow, and you will have communion with God, and everything will function the way it should. The third thing that we see here is in verse 25 and 26. Agree with thine adversary while thou art in the way with him. Now, the first one was offensive action. You take the initiative. This is defensive action. If you don't do this, you're going to be in trouble. You're just simply sort of defending yourself. Act before the offended party takes the initiative. Because once the offended party takes the initiative, you don't have much chance. All right? So this is defensive action. When the offended party goes into action, the opportune moment has passed. The anger has escalated to a risky point, perhaps beyond remedy. Now, this doesn't just work at the individual level. This works everywhere. In France, the poor people were mistreated for years and years and years. And finally, they reacted
and we had a bloodbath. I mean, God has just simply built this into the way things work. The poor people in Russia were not treated equitably by rich people. Even I'm studying right now to give a talk on the Russian Mennonites. In the Russian colonies, it was just as bad or worse than it was out there as far as the discrepancy between rich and poor. And finally, the Marxists rose up, and we have what we have. And that's what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying that he built into the human experience is a reaction. If you don't deal with this at this level, if you don't deal with it at this level, there is going to be a major catastrophe. This is a volatile situation. I remember the Ledoux case. And in that court trial, Mr. Breshu was a friend of mine. He was the one that defended them. He had written a letter one time that kept me from having a lawsuit. And so I walked up front and he knew who I was. And we got to talking about this case. And he said, John, this case has nothing to do with money. This is all about an insult that they have to have justice for. And I won't go into details because it involves people that you know. But it's a case in point. If somebody had gone before that court case was planned and so on, and had just gone to that family and had said, we are sorry, what can we do to make this right? That case would have never gone to court. We eliminate enemies by turning them into friends. God wants us to cultivate a loving reverence for all humanity. Enthusiasm for the potential of humanity is the heart of the gospel. That's why Jesus spent all his time with these people. He had a passion. He had an enthusiasm for what people could become by the gospel. Lord Chesterton said of St. Francis, the secret of his success was his profound belief in other people. He used to talk to thieves and robbers about the misfortune that they could not give vent to their desire for holiness. I thought that was interesting. He used to talk to thieves and robbers about their misfortune that they could not give vent to a desire they really had for holiness. General Booth stood before Queen Victoria, and she said, what can I do for you? And he said, Your Majesty, some people's passion is for money. Some people's passion is for fame. But my passion is for men. When the armistice to World War I, I'm just giving you some beautiful examples. When the armistice for World War I was signed, the news came to a meeting of Methodist Episcopal bishops. And like everybody else, they were delirious with joy. So they asked one of their number to give a speech. And he stood up and this is what he said. Now let us give just as much brotherly treatment to our black brothers in England. Let's not make the mistake, in closing, that a young lady named Sandra made. She was taking a religious class in a college. And the teacher of that class always had amazing object lessons of what he wanted to teach. So when they came in one day and they saw a paper target on the wall, they knew that they were in for some sort of excitement. So he told them that he wanted them to draw a picture of an enemy. And then they were going to put that picture up there and they were going to throw darts at the picture. And so she had someone who had stolen her boyfriend, and she was quite angry with that person. So she put great pains into drawing her pictures, making sure that all the pimples and so on that person's face were there to make them look as ugly as possible. And so the students stepped up, and they put the pictures up there, and they threw their darts so hard, they ripped the paper, and I mean, it was just awful, and she just couldn't wait to put her picture up there. But before she could do that, he said, well, we're out of time. the rest of you have to go back to your seat. She was so disappointed that she didn't get to put her picture up there and throw darts at it. And then after they were all seated, he took all the pictures away. And behind the pictures was the face of Christ. And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. If we could always remember that. All of those negative things we are doing to Christ. So let's celebrate humanity. Let's have a passion for men. Let's eliminate every enemy by esteeming them better than ourselves and treating them accordingly. This will be, as Jesus clearly told us, the greatest evidence of grace, the grace of God and the hope for humanity. Does anybody have any comments you'd like to make?